The Institute.
Institute.
Institute for Justice.
The National Law Firm for Liberty.
Hello and welcome to Short Circuit, your generally bi-weekly podcast on the Federal Courts of Appeals. I'm your host, John Ross, joined this week by IJ litigator Rob Piccola, as well as Sheldon Gilbert, the director of IJ's Center for Judicial Engagement. This week on the show, a trio of property rights cases. We'll start things off in the Seventh Circuit, where Springfield, Illinois officials are threatening to evict three renters at a group home for disabled adults. The issue is that their group home is less than 600 feet away from another group home for disabled adults, which zoning ordinances do not allow for. Sheldon.
Yeah, it's I think it's first important to clarify exactly what we mean when we say that this is a group home. Basically, there's a nonprofit organization that is kind of the Uber for individuals with disabilities. The organization will match up people who want to live in private residences and receive assistance to be able to live independent lives. And they match them up with homeowners, landlords who can provide housing that matches their needs. So in this particular case, the nonprofit organization matched up three individuals with disabilities with homeowners who were willing to substantially modify their house by widening doorways to make it so that wheelchairs can get into the home and move around, lower the kitchen sink, all the different things that you'd need to be able to facilitate independent living in that home. So this nonprofit organization kind of matched these two groups up. And the landlords, the homeowners, again, like I said, went to great lengths to modify the actual house in order for these three individuals to live there. Meanwhile, somebody, and I don't think we know from the record who, somebody reported this home, these three individuals, to Springfield, Illinois, zoning police, and said, hey, this is violates the zoning code that, as John suggested, says that that group homes for individuals with disabilities can't be closer than 600 feet to each other. And apparently across the street, unbeknownst to any of the three individuals that planned to move into the home or the homeowners who modified their home to rent it, unbeknownst to anybody, across the street there is a home which is designated as a group home for individuals with disabilities. And they'd been operating there for something like 12 years. And so the city comes in and says, well, because it's across the street, you're something like 100 feet away, you cannot operate as a quote-unquote group home because of the existence of this home across the street. So the first thing that the three individuals and the landlords try to do is they try and go to the city and say, okay, fine, you know, we understand that this ordinance exists. Can we get a variance? Can we get an exception to the rule so that we can operate in this particular way? And the city says no. They deny the permit.
The neighbors come out of the woodwork to oppose the permit being granted, right? And some of their, well, they don't strike me as particularly sympathetic claims to why this home would be a detriment to the neighborhood.
Yeah, I think that's a typical scenario, and it reminds me of a Supreme Court case, a rather famous Supreme Court case called Cleburne Independent Living Center. And this is a case that involved a homeowner who also wanted to have people with disabilities, in particular intellectual disabilities, live in her home. And the neighbor said, you know, well, we think it's great that people with disabilities should have an independent lifestyle and should be able to live in, you know, neighborhoods like the rest of us, just not our neighborhood. I recently looked at a transcript from a Today Show interview with the neighbors in this Cleburne Living Center case from 1985. And that's exactly what the neighbor said. The neighbor said, well, we're kind of scared of people with disabilities. We're worried about the things that they'll do.
Yeah, there's a high school nearby.
Yeah, there's a junior high nearby, and we're worried that the junior high kids will make fun of them, so we don't think they should live near us, right?
And in this case, the neighbors seem to direct their discomfort toward the staff of the facility, that they were playing loud music in their cars and zipping through the residential streets too fast, and that having employees nearby was going to be a detriment to the residential bucolic character of this neighborhood.
Yeah. It's an interesting question to what extent that is really what's driving the kind of the concerns of the neighbors. But that brings us to the litigation where the three individuals who had planned to live there filed a lawsuit alleging that the city of Springfield had violated a number of federal statutes, including the Fair Housing Act and other, you know, disability-specific statutes that prohibit discrimination based on disability. And the legal question in the case is whether the lower court properly granted a preliminary injunction to keep the city from evicting these individuals from the home while the case proceeded to determine whether or not the home violated the ordinance, or in the alternative, whether or not the city had violated the federal statutes. So that's the legal question, was whether or not a preliminary injunction was appropriate.
And how did the Seventh Circuit decide that question, Rob?
They decided that the preliminary injunction was appropriate. There was more than a negligible chance of prevailing on the merits of these claims under the Fair Housing Act and Americans with Disability Act, FHA, ADA. You know, in federal litigation, we always risk drowning in alphabet soup, because there are so many acronyms, there are so many shorthand ways of referring to this massive federal statutory and regulatory body out there. Do you ever notice that reading these opinions?
I have. And one thing I noticed was that there were no constitutional claims. What do you make of that?
I think it's easier to travel under these statutes that have a specific test that's carved out and specific precedent. And, you know, when you have a constitutional claim, in some manner, you're trying to upend either an existing statute or system, and it's easier to defend a rule of law or defend a statute than it is to challenge one. So I really don't blame them for doing this for their clients. I mean, I think that was the most expeditious way to get this resolved for these folks. I mean, I think too about, they were willing to evict them. I was shocked, actually. They were willing to go hull hog and just throw these people out. I was surprised that they were so aggressive in going after these folks.
Well, let's get back to the Cleburne case, because that did present constitutional questions.
Right. And I think it supports exactly what Rob is saying in terms of the calculus that the individuals and the lawyers probably made in terms of whether or not to bring a constitutional claim, arguing that the city violated the 14th Amendment's equal protection clause, or whether to proceed with federal statutes. Now, in the Cleburne case, which is 30 years old at this point, the Independent Living Center, you know, sued and said, hey, you can't discriminate against disability housing, individuals with disability, in terms of how we use our property, because there's no rational basis for you to do it, right? The Supreme Court used the rational basis test and basically kind of knocked out all of the city's justifications for why it didn't want that independent living center to be opened in that particular place, and all that was left was, you know, animus against people with disabilities, right? And so it's one of those rare cases where the Supreme Court, applying the rational basis test to a quote-unquote non-suspect class, to people with disabilities, decided that the state had gone too far and did so unanimously in a 9-0 decision. But whether or not that could be replicated is a big question. And I think that the litigants probably decided that they were better off arguing that it violated federal statutes, where there's, as Rob said, very clear tests. It's a route that might be easier for judges to be able to go, rather than, you know, a constitutional claim under the Equal Protection Clause, where they're going to run into the rational basis test.
And that's what makes IJ cases so special, is that we are willing to go from soup to nuts to be able to get that constitutional issue on the table in a way that private parties, by no fault of their own, just don't have the strategic or financial resources to do.
You know, the other interesting piece about this case is that it has since triggered a federal investigation and subsequent federal lawsuit by the Trump administration's Department of Justice, which has now sued the city of Springfield, saying you are violating the Fair Housing Act because you are systematically discriminating against people with disability by virtue of this statute of this ordinance. And so that lawsuit, I think, was filed in November. We'll see where that goes. But I think it's the point is that, you know, in litigation like this to vindicate a particular right can have all sorts of different interesting consequences in terms of who gets involved after the fact. I also kind of think of these cases as something of a Rorschach test. You can think of this case and the Cleburne case as a case about the rights of people with disabilities, or you can think about it as a case of as a case about property rights. There are lots of different ways that you can think about what this case is about. But at bottom, you have a government which is saying, you know, you have property, and we are not going to let you use it in this particular way. And in a case like this, we're not going to let you use it in this particular way because of our views about a group of people, the characteristics of a group of people, in this case, people with disabilities.
Okay, well, let's move on to the next case, which comes out of the California Court of Appeals, and it involves a gentleman who in 1999 applied for permits from San Mateo County, which is 20 miles south of San Francisco, to build two large houses, I think beachfront houses, on lots that he owned. And now here we are 18 years later, and no homes have been built, and much litigation has transpired. Rob, fill in the blanks for us.
Well, many of these blanks will never be filled in. This is sort of like looking at a case through a kaleidoscope. When a case goes on for decades of going through various, you saw in one instance, I think there were four levels of review just to get to a court from the zoning folks. And I'm sure for this gentleman who's been trying for decades now to build these houses, it's as close to a black hole as he ever hopes to get. And I hate to be nihilistic about it, but it will probably never be resolved in a way that gets to the true intended use of what this gentleman wanted to do. And you find it sort of whack-a-mole. So there's sort of different tracks, sometimes intersecting ones, that a case like this can get on. So there's many sort of sub-disputes that come up, lots of games of gotcha, you didn't raise this or preserve this, you didn't challenge this sufficiently enough, just to give an example of these two tracks coalescing. One side issue that sort of became the dominant plot point was whether this could be compartmentalized into two different lots. And there was ultimately a determination that it was just one huge lot. Well, parallel with that, at these different zoning sort of appeal mechanisms, you had all of these disputes about the size of the proposed houses, about essentially the aesthetics of it. And there had to be such a tightly focused T-crossing, I-dotting, that the sort of gist that you get from this is that there was no way this was ever going to happen the way he wanted it. The mechanisms that were in place to grind construction to a halt in the local California government did what they intended to do, which was stop it. So I focus so much on the procedure here because when you have this many layers of permission needed to use your own property for a project of your choosing, it essentially leaves you both with no way to complete the project, but also no real way to defend the financial investment that you've made in court. So this was sort of a depressing, decades-long journey that, unfortunately, to this day, seems to be unresolved.
Yeah, The whole opinion, and I recommend that you read it because it's really remarkable. The 20 years of the attempts to get this plot approved to build these two homes really reminds me of Charlie Brown and Lucy in the football, right? Again and again, the zoning board says, you know, we're going to pre-approve your proposal to build, you know, these two houses. And then they yank back the pre-approval, right? And then they pre-approve it again, and they yank back the pre-approval. And then they pre-approve it again, and then they yank back the pre-approval because of, you know, concerns by the community about, as Rob said, the aesthetics of the house, whether or not there should be one house or two houses, how big the house should be. It is really depressing because you see the zoning board doing it over and over again, and there's no accountability for that, right? The legal issue in the case is whether or not the claim for the inverse condemnation claim, basically that by virtue of this regulatory apparatus and this continual denial of these permits, whether the county has effectively taken that property and deprived of its economic utility by virtue of this permitting process, right? This is an inverse condemnation claim. And so the legal question is whether or not that claim is ripe yet. And the county says, well, you know, we haven't actually denied his a building permit yet, and we haven't completely, totally, 100% foreclosed him from building what he wants to build. Now, he could have resolved this at any point he wanted by just deciding to build something else, right? If he'd decided not to build, you know, a house of the size that he wanted or of the aesthetics that he wanted, he could have solved this problem himself by just choosing to build something that he didn't want to do. And so, you know, until that moment when we give, you know, a final, complete denial of his ability to use his property in any way, this case is not ripe. And the California Court of Appeals said, yeah, we agree. This case isn't ripe. He's got to keep going back, and the county's just going to keep, you know, holding that football, and Charlie Brown's going to keep trying to kick it, and this guy's just going to keep falling over.
And the thing is no matter what he did, the result would probably be the same. When he came back with new plans, they said, well, you're just tinkering at the margins. You didn't really change. You didn't make it either small enough or it didn't somehow comport with this invisible bubble above our heads. And 20 years from now, we may still be sitting here because it got bounced back again. Because as long as there is a well to keep drinking the poison of regulation from, this man will have a draft for the rest of his life.
Well, and this brings Rob highlights kind of the bigger issue here, right? You know, this is a gentleman who has not given up, who's been trying for 20 years to build his house. But what are the consequences for the broader community because of regulatory burdens like this? And you know, I found an interesting study that was performed recently trying to figure out what is the reason for the skyrocketing costs of housing in California. There's lots of research on the California housing crisis, that there's far too little housing for the number of people who are in California as a consequence. You know, supply and demand, prices for housing are incredibly high. So a study done by Point Loma Nazarene University, it was commissioned by the Building Industry Association, estimates that up to 40% of the cost of a new home can be attributed to the regulatory process like this, right? 40% of the home isn't about the cost of the labor to build the home. It's not about the cost of the lumber to build the home. It's not about the actual physical land you have to buy to build the home. It's not about any of that. It's just compliance with regulations or the lost opportunity because regulations make building new homes impossible. And so there's a real burden for real people across the board by having a regulatory apparatus like this and having courts like the California Court of Appeals, you know, buying into it and you know, saying, you know what, Lucy, it's okay for you to keep, you know, taking the football away. We're not going to hold you accountable. There's a cost to that.
Is there an avenue to challenge this county's specific zoning regulations? Because they're above and beyond. You can't just, as a developer or a landowner, you can't just like look at the zoning regulations and be like, aha, I need to build this far back from the property line and I can only build so high. There's nothing objective about it. The zoning code says, it specifically gives the authorities and your neighbors a veto authority purely for subjective aesthetic elements. I mean, is that, how does that fly?
Yeah, well, I think that's part of the problem, right? It's not just that you have all sorts of different regulatory bodies. So this study that I mentioned says that in California, and I think the state level alone, there are something like 45 regulatory bodies involved in you know, building new houses, right? So it's not just the number of regulatory bodies or the number of regulations, but it's precisely correct that many of these ordinances are so vague that they can be easily manipulated, right? So you can have other property owners, you know, coming into the process and basically, you know, co-opting the power of the state to prevent other people from using, you know, their own property the way that they want. And you can almost always find some sort of vague hook in the zoning ordinances to be able to do that. So I think you've hit on a real problem.
And also, under the language in this case, there's really no vested right until there's been some sort of conditional approval by the government. And there was a lengthy discussion distinguishing this case from another one in which that preliminary approval had been given. So it becomes very circular. In a way, it's that your property rights come from the government at that point, and unless they give them, you don't have them and then can't challenge it. It's a horrible sort of hamster wheel of trying to use this property you've invested in.
Okay, well, let's move on to the final case, which comes out of Scotts Township, Pennsylvania. It's a rural community in eastern Pennsylvania where the plaintiff owns 90 acres, a 90-acre farm, and the city has passed an ordinance saying that city officials and the members of the general public are allowed to come onto private property whenever they want, well, on daylight hours, if they suspect, rightly or wrongly, that there's a graveyard on those properties. City officials think that there are some old stones arranged in such a way that there might be a graveyard on her property. We don't really know. And she's challenging the city and the general public's kind of, their right of access to her land.
Well, the only way to know for sure whether it was a graveyard is exhumation, a very unpleasant topic and one that this opinion doesn't delve into. And I wonder if there will ever be a sort of definitive answer to that. But in the meantime, it gets into interesting Fourth Amendment doctrines. There is a doctrine called open fields, where the typical privacy expectations that our framers had decided would be included in the Fourth Amendment, there's an exception because it's open and visible, and if not directly attached to the area surrounding the house, this is a term of art, the curtilage surrounding the house, then there aren't those privacy protections there. And the Fourth Amendment claim was basically disposed of on this case, and the bulk of the analysis and the opinion went to the takings issue, which was also similar to the last case we discussed, riddled with this requirement to keep going back, to keep getting back on that hamster wheel at the lower court levels to push these claims forward, which, as we saw, I mean, with this case in California taking 20 years, not everyone has the resources, the money, the time to be able to litigate a case like that. Essentially, the argument for the taking here was that by making this supposed graveyard open for business hours without compensation, that this amounted to a taking of this woman's property. Well, unless she were to go through and litigate the exact compensation issue, it basically foreclosed her asserting her rights in federal court.
Meaning that unless she went to the government and demanded payment, she wasn't allowed to bring the takings claim at all.
Yeah.
Yeah, this goes back to a 1985 Supreme Court case called Williamson County that basically says, in order for you to vindicate your federal property rights under the takings clause, which has been incorporated through the 14th Amendment. If you want to vindicate your federal property rights and you think that a state or local government has violated them, you have to first exhaust all of your options to try and vindicate those rights in state court before you can go into federal court and, you know, try and vindicate those federal rights. The interesting thing here is that she actually tried to go to state court first, and the state court said, no, we can't hear your suit, right? So then she went to federal court, and the federal court said, well, you didn't exhaust all your options in the state courts, so go back and try again. And now this is what, you know, this goes up to the Supreme Court on this question, like maybe this whole regime, this Williamson County regime that requires you to exhaust all of your remedies in you know, state courts before you can go to the federal courts. Maybe this is wrong and it ought to be overturned. And the Supreme Court has granted review to decide that.
And it's unique to property rights cases. There are no other areas of law where you first have to exhaust everything in state court, correct?
Yeah. I mean, think of it this way. Suppose that the county had told her that she had to put up a sign on her property. Whatever the sign is, you know, whatever the message is the government wanted to require her to say. And she says, wait a second, you know, the government can't force me to say things that I don't want to say. You know, this is a violation of my First Amendment free speech rights. We would find it bizarre to require her to first go through an administrative process to challenge the compelled speech, you know, through the state, to then litigate all the way through the state courts and lose before she could go into a federal court to get a federal court to decide whether or not her free speech rights had been violated. We would find that odd. We would find it deeply problematic that you are forcing somebody to carry speech that they don't want to carry for as long as that state process, goes on.
Well, if I could just interrupt you, I mean, why is that so odd? Like, maybe it just makes sense. I mean, playing devil's advocate here, maybe the state courts just know, you know, their areas better.
I mean, that's a good question. I think that the answer lies in the deep and fascinating history of the 14th Amendment itself, right? The 13th Amendment is the amendment that prohibits slavery. It's adopted, ratified by the states at the as the Civil War is ending, and the purpose of this was to prohibit slavery in every part of the United States. Well, the states and the state courts, particularly the southern states and southern state courts, resisted the 13th Amendment, and they tried to recreate slavery in all but name by passing all sorts of ordinances that required, for example, freed individuals to get government permission before they could be anything except a farmer, right? And the state courts were routinely denying all of these different rights, speech rights, property rights to these freed slaves. And Congress looked at this kind of record of the southern states and southern state courts and southern state governments routinely abridging, you know, the rights of individuals in their states, and basically said, you know, we don't think that the state governments can be trusted. We don't think the state courts in particular can be trusted. So we're going to create a new amendment, the 14th Amendment, to clarify that these individuals have federal constitutional rights and provide a federal mechanism by which those rights can be vindicated. And that includes the takings clause as it's applied to the states through the 14th Amendment. So I think that that's part of the answer, right? That the reason we should be troubled by this is because the 14th Amendment, which makes these lawsuits against state and local governments possible, these property lawsuits or First Amendment lawsuits, it was designed and it was understood at the time to be addressing this problem that we can't trust state and local governments to vindicate these federal rights.
I would be interested to see how a claim like this would fare in Pennsylvania state court. I will say, you know, that wasn't the claim here, but Article 1, Section 8 of the Pennsylvania Constitution actually predates the U.S. Constitution. It was drafted in 1776 at the time we had colonies subject to British general warrants, and Pennsylvania's constitution and indeed Pennsylvania state courts have a more jealous guardianship of those privacy rights sometimes than the federal courts. So it may be that a case like this or with these kind of claims has a chance someday in Pennsylvania state court. So it'd be interesting to, as a side note, to see how that would
would play.
I don't kind of follow that because she originally filed her case in Pennsylvania State Court, right?
Yeah, but I don't think it was under Article 1, Section 8.
I see.
Yeah, this is a terrific, friendly, quasi-regular reminder that state constitutions exist and often provide greater protections than the federal constitution provides, or at least has been recognized to provide. That said, again, if there is a, it might be that state law would provide greater protections, but the question is whether or not you should be required to go through the state court process to vindicate a federal, a recognized, established federal constitutional right. And that's where it's rather weird that we have this regime where property rights require you to go through all of the state process to vindicate, whereas, you know, free speech rights, you can go straight to federal court to vindicate those rights. And that's what the Supreme Court's going to decide in this Williams in this case, now that it's reached the Supreme Court, whether or not that Williamson County decision that requires you to kind of go through the state courts and the state administrative process before you can go to the federal courts, whether or not that was wrongly decided. And by the way, a host of justices on the Supreme Court have strongly criticized that Williamson County decision from 1985, and have questioned whether or not it's constitutional to have this structure, including, you know, justices like Justice Thomas, former Justice Scalia, and others.
Okay, that concludes the show. Thanks for listening, and be sure to follow Sheldon on Twitter, where he posts daily threads on legal history under the hashtag CourtingHistory. His handle is @SheldonGilbert. We've posted a link to his tweet story about the Cleburne case that we discussed in the first case today to our SoundCloud page. And so until next time, this is John Ross, pressing you to get engaged.